not, in fact, been robbed. Such thinking comes from a wretched allegiance to the notion of scarcity, from the belief that the world is a place of dearth and that there will never be enough of anything to go around. The motto of this mentality is, "Somebody else got mine." Had I decided to take that attitude, I would surely have lost my dear new friend. I also would have collapsed into a state of resentment, jealousy, and blame. Alternatively, I could have turned the anger upon myself. I could have said to myself, "See, here's the ultimate proof that you're a loser, Liz, because you never deliver on anything. This novel wanted to be yours, but you blew it because you suck and you're lazy and you're stupid and because you always put your attention in the wrong place, and that's why you'll never be great." Lastly, I could have put the hate on destiny. I could have said, "Herein lies the evidence that God loves Anne Patchett more than he loves me, for Anne is the chosen novelist, and I, as I have always suspected in my darkest moments, am merely a fraud. I am being mocked by fate while her cup runneth over. I am fortune's fool, and she is fortune's darling, and such is the eternal injustice and tragedy of my cursed existence." But I didn't do any of that garbage. Instead, I chose to regard this event as having been a terrific little miracle. I allowed myself to feel grateful and astonished to have played any part whatsoever in its strange unfolding. This was the closest I'd ever felt to sorcery, and I wasn't about to waste that amazing experience by playing small. I saw this incident as a rare and glittering piece of evidence that all my most outlandish beliefs about creativity might actually be true, that ideas are alive, that ideas do seek the most available human collaborator, that ideas do have a conscious will, that ideas do move from soul to soul, that ideas will always try to seek the swiftest and most efficient conduit to earth, just as lightning does. Furthermore, I was now inclined to believe that ideas also have wit, because what had transpired between Anne and me was not only phenomenal, but also curiously and charmingly funny. Ownership. I believe that inspiration will always try its best to work with you, but if you are not ready or available, it may indeed choose to leave you and to search for a different human collaborator. This happens to people a lot, actually. This is how it comes to pass that one morning you open up the newspaper and discover that somebody else has written your book, or directed your play, or released your record, or produced your movie, or founded your business, or launched your restaurant, or patented your invention, or in any way whatsoever manifested some spark of inspiration that you'd had years ago, but had never entirely cultivated, or had never gotten around to finishing. This may vex you, but it really shouldn't, because you didn't deliver. You didn't show up ready enough, or fast enough, or openly enough for the idea to take hold within you and complete itself. Therefore, the idea went hunting for a new partner, and somebody else got to make the thing. In the years since I published Eat, Pray, Love, I cannot tell you, it is literally beyond my ability to count, how many people have accused me in anger of having written their book. "That book was supposed to be mine," they growl, glaring down at me in the signing line at some book event in Houston or Toronto or Dublin or Melbourne. "I was definitely planning to write that book someday. You wrote my life." But what can I say? What do I know about that stranger's life? From my perspective, I found an unattended idea lying around and I ran away with it. Well, it is true that I got lucky with Eat, Pray, Love. Without a doubt, I got exceedingly lucky. It is also true that I worked on that book like a maniac. I spun myself like a dervish around that idea. Once it entered my consciousness, I didn't let it out of my sight for a moment, not until the book was good and finished. So I got to keep that one. But I've lost a good number of ideas over the years, too, or rather, I've lost ideas that I mistakenly thought were meant to be mine. Other people got to write books that I dearly longed to write. Other people made projects that might have been mine. Here's one. In 2006, I toyed for a while with the idea of writing a sprawling nonfiction history of Newark, New Jersey, and to call it Brick City. My notional plan was to follow around Newark's charismatic new mayor, Cory Booker, and to write about his efforts to transform this fascinating but troubled town. A cool idea, but I didn't get around to it. To be honest, it seemed like a lot of work, and I already had another book brewing, so I never quite revved up enough juice to take it on. Then, in 2009, the Sundance Channel produced and aired a sprawling documentary about the troubled history of Newark, New Jersey, and about Cory Booker's efforts to turn the town around. The show was called Brick City. My reaction upon hearing this was one of sheer relief, Hooray! I don't have to tackle Newark. Someone else took on the assignment. Here's another one. In 1996, I met a guy who was a good friend of Ozzy Osbourne's. He told me that the Osbourne family were the strangest, funniest, wildest, and most oddly loving people he had ever met. He said, you've got to write something about them. You should just hang out with them and watch the way they interact. I don't know exactly what you should do about them, but somebody has to do a project around the Osbournes because they're too fantastic to believe. I was intrigued, but again, I never got around to it, and somebody else ended up taking on the Osbournes, to noteworthy effect. There are so many ideas that I never got around to, and often they became someone else's projects. Other people told stories that were intimately familiar to me, stories that had once been called to my attention or seemed to have come from my own life or could have been generated by my imagination. Sometimes I haven't been so nonchalant about losing those ideas to other creators. Sometimes it's been painful. Sometimes I've had to watch as other people enjoyed successes and victories that I once desired for myself. Them's the breaks, though. But them's also the beautiful mysteries. Multiple discovery. When I contemplated things even further, I realized that what had transpired between me and Ann Patchett could have been the artistic version of multiple discovery, a term used in the scientific community whenever two or more scientists in different parts of the world come up with the same idea at the same time. Calculus, oxygen, black holes, the Möbius strip, the existence of the stratosphere, and the theory of evolution, just to name a few, all had multiple discoverers. There's no logical explanation for why this occurs. How can two people who have never heard of each other's work both arrive at the same scientific conclusions at the same historical moment? Yet it happens more often than you might imagine. When the 19th century Hungarian mathematician János Bolyai invented non-Euclidean geometry, his father urged him to publish his findings immediately before someone else landed on the same idea, saying, "When the time is ripe for certain things, they appear at different places in the manner of violets coming to light in early spring." Multiple discovery happens outside the scientific sphere, too. In the business world, for instance, there's a general understanding that a big new idea is out there, floating around in the atmosphere, and that the first person or company to grab hold of it will likewise seize the competitive advantage. Sometimes everyone's grabbing at once in a mad scramble to be first. See the rise of personal computers in the 1990s. Multiple discovery even happens in romantic relationships. Nobody's been interested in you for years and years, and suddenly you have two suitors at the same time. That's multiple discovery indeed. To me, multiple discovery just looks like inspiration hedging its bets, fiddling with the dials, working two channels at the same time. Inspiration is allowed to do that if it wants to. Inspiration is allowed to do whatever it wants to, in fact. And it is never obliged to justify its motives to any of us. As far as I'm concerned, we're lucky that inspiration talks to us at all. It's too much to ask that it also explain itself. In the end, it's all just violets trying to come to light. Don't fret about the irrationality and unpredictability of all this strangeness. Give in to it. Such is the bizarre, unearthly contract of creative living. There is no theft, there is no ownership, there is no tragedy, there is no problem. There is no time or space where inspiration comes from, and also no competition, no ego, no limitations. There is only the stubbornness of the idea itself, refusing to stop searching until it has found an equally stubborn collaborator, or multiple collaborators, as the case may be. Work with that stubbornness. Work with it as openly and trustingly and diligently as you can. Work with all your heart, because I promise, if you show up for your work day after day after day after day, you just might get lucky enough some random morning to burst right into bloom. The Tiger's Tail. One of the best descriptions I've ever heard of this phenomenon, that is, of ideas entering and exiting the human consciousness at whim, came from the wonderful American poet, Ruth Stone. I met Stone when she was nearly 90 years old, and she regaled me with stories about her extraordinary creative process. She told me that when she was a child growing up on a farm in rural Virginia, she would be out working in the fields when she would sometimes hear a poem coming toward her, hear it rushing across the landscape at her like a galloping horse. Whenever this happened, she knew exactly what she had to do next. She would run like hell toward the house, trying to stay ahead of the poem, hoping to get to a piece of paper and a pencil fast enough to catch it. That way, when the poem reached her and passed through her, she would be able to grab it and take dictation, letting the words pour forth onto the page. Sometimes, however, she was too slow, and she couldn't get to the paper and pencil in time. At those instances, she could feel the poem rushing right through her body and out the other side. It would be in her for a moment, seeking a response, and then it would be gone before she could grasp it, galloping away across the earth, as she said, searching for another poet. But sometimes, and this is the wildest part, she would nearly miss the poem, but not quite. She would just barely catch it, she explained, by the tail, like grabbing a tiger. Then she would almost physically pull the poem back into her with one hand, even as she was taking dictation with the other. In these instances, the poem would appear on the page from the last word to the first, backward, but otherwise intact. That, my friends, is some freaky, old-timey, voodoo-style big magic right there. I believe in it, though. Hard labor versus fairy dust. I believe in it because I believe we are all capable at times of brushing up against a sense of mystery and inspiration in our lives. Maybe we can't all be pure divine channels like Ruth Stone, pouring forth unadulterated creation every single day without obstacle or doubt, but we may be able to draw nearer to that source than we think. Most of my writing life, to be perfectly honest, is not freaky old-timey voodoo-style big magic. Most of my writing life consists of nothing more than unglamorous, disciplined labor. I sit at my desk and I work like a farmer, and that's how it gets done. Most of it is not fairy dust in the least. But sometimes it is fairy dust. Sometimes when I'm in the midst of writing, I feel like I'm suddenly walking on one of those moving sidewalks that you find in a big airport terminal. I still have a long slog to my gait and my baggage is still heavy, but I can feel myself being gently propelled by some exterior force. Something is carrying me along, something powerful and generous, and that something is decidedly not me. You may know this feeling. It's the feeling you get when you've made something wonderful or done something wonderful, and when you look back at it later, all you can say is, I don't even know where that came from. You can't repeat it, you can't explain it, but it felt as if you were being guided. I only rarely experience this feeling, but it's the most magnificent sensation imaginable when it arrives. I don't think there is a more perfect happiness to be found in life than this state, except perhaps falling in love. In ancient Greek, the word for the highest degree of human happiness is eudaimonia, which basically means well-demoned, that is, nicely taken care of by some external divine creative spirit guide. Modern commentators, perhaps uncomfortable with this sense of divine mystery, simply call it flow, or being in the zone. But the Greeks and the Romans both believed in the idea of an external demon of creativity, a sort of house elf, if you will, who lived within the walls of your home and who sometimes aided you in your labors. The Romans had a specific term for that helpful house elf. They called it your genius, your guardian deity, the conduit of your inspiration. Which is to say, the Romans didn't believe that an exceptionally gifted person was a genius. They believed that an exceptionally gifted person had a genius. It's a subtle but important distinction, being versus having, and I think it's a wise psychological construct. The idea of an external genius helps to keep the artist's ego in check, distancing him somewhat from the burden of taking either full credit or full blame for the outcome of his work. If your work is successful, in other words, you are obliged to thank your external genius for the help, thus holding you back from total narcissism. And if your work fails, it's not entirely your fault. You can say, hey, don't look at me, my genius didn't show up today. Either way, the vulnerable human ego is protected. Protected from the corrupting influence of praise, protected from the corrosive effects of shame. Pinned beneath the boulder. I think society did a great disservice to artists when we started saying that certain people were geniuses instead of saying that they had geniuses. That happened around the Renaissance with the rise of a more rational and human-centered view of life. The gods and the mysteries fell away, and suddenly we put all the credit and blame for creativity on the artists themselves, making the all-too-fragile humans completely responsible for the vagaries of inspiration. In the process, we also venerated art and artists beyond their appropriate stations. The distinction of being a genius and the rewards and status often associated with it elevated creators into something like a priestly caste, perhaps even into minor deities, which I think is a bit too much pressure for mere mortals, no matter how talented. That's when artists started to really crack, driven mad and broken in half by the weight and weirdness of their gifts. When artists are burdened with the label of genius, I think they lose the ability to take themselves lightly or to create freely. Consider Harper Lee, for instance, who wrote nothing for decades after the phenomenal success of To Kill a Mockingbird. In 1962, when Lee was asked how she felt about the possibility of ever writing another book, she replied, "I'm scared." She also said, "When you're at the top, there's only one way to go." Because Lee never elaborated more definitively on her situation, we will never know why this wildly successful author didn't go on to write dozens more books in her lifetime. But I wonder if perhaps she had become pinned beneath the boulder of her own reputation. Maybe it all got too heavy, too freighted with responsibility, and her artistry died of fear, or worse, of self-competition. What was there for Harper Lee to be afraid of, after all? Perhaps just this, that she could not outdo Harper Lee. As for having reached the top with only one way to go from there, Lee had a point, no? I mean, if you cannot repeat a once-in-a-lifetime miracle, if you can never again reach the top, then why bother creating at all? Well, I can actually speak about this predicament from personal experience because I myself was once at the top with a book that sat on the bestseller list for more than 3 years. I can't tell you how many people said to me during those years, "How are you ever going to top that?" They'd speak of my great good fortune as though it were a curse, not a blessing, and would speculate about how terrified I must feel at the prospect of not being able to reach such phenomenal heights again. But such thinking assumes there is a top, and that reaching that top and staying there is the only motive one has to create. Such thinking assumes that the mysteries of inspiration operate on the same scale that we do, on a limited human scale of success and failure, of winning and losing, of comparison and competition, of commerce and reputation, of units sold and influence wielded. Such thinking assumes that you must be constantly victorious, not only against your peers, but also against an earlier version of your own poor self. Most dangerously of all, such thinking assumes that if you cannot win, then you must not continue to play. But what does any of that have to do with vocation? What does any of that have to do with the pursuit of love? What does any of that have to do with the strange communion between the human and the magical? What does any of that have to do with faith? What does any of that have to do with the quiet glory of merely making things and then sharing those things with an open heart and no expectations? I wish that Harper Lee had kept writing. I wish that right after Mockingbird and her Pulitzer Prize, she had churned out 5 cheap and easy books in a row, a light romance, a police procedural, a children's story, a cookbook, some kind of pulpy action-adventure story, anything. You might think I'm kidding, but I'm not. Imagine what she might have created, even accidentally, with such an approach. At the very least, she could have tricked everyone into forgetting that she'd once been Harper Lee. She could have tricked herself into forgetting that she'd once been Harper Lee, which might have been artistically liberating. Fortunately, after so many decades of silence, we do get to hear more of Lee's voice. Recently, a lost early manuscript of hers was discovered, a novel that she wrote before To Kill a Mockingbird. In other words, a book that she wrote before the entire world was watching and waiting for what she would do next, hovering with expectation. But I wish someone had been able to convince Lee to keep writing for the entirety of her life and to keep publishing all along. It would have been a gift to the world. And it would have been a gift to her as well, to have been able to remain a writer and to have enjoyed the pleasures and satisfactions of that work for herself, because in the end, creativity is a gift to the creator, not just a gift to the audience. I wish somebody had given Ralph Ellison the same sort of advice. Just write anything and put it out there with reckless abandon. And F. Scott Fitzgerald, too, and any other creator, famous or obscure, who ever vanished beneath the shadow of their own real or imagined reputation. I wish that somebody had told them all to go fill up a bunch of pages with blah, 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 and just publish it for heaven's sake and ignore the outcome. Does it seem sacrilegious even to suggest this? Good. Just because creativity is mystical doesn't mean it shouldn't also be demystified, especially if it means liberating artists from the confines of their own grandiosity, panic, and ego. Let it come and go. The most important thing to understand about eudaimonia, though, about that exhilarating encounter between a human being and divine creative inspiration is that you cannot expect it to be there for you all the time. It will come and go, and you must let it come and go. I know this personally because my genius, wherever it comes from, does not keep regular hours. My genius, for what he is worth, does not work on human time, and he certainly doesn't arrange his schedule around my convenience. Sometimes I suspect that my genius might be moonlighting on the side of somebody else's genius, maybe even working for a bunch of different artists, like some kind of freelance creative contractor. Sometimes I grope around in the dark, desperately looking for magical creative stimulus, and all I come up with is something that feels like a damp washcloth. And then, suddenly, whoosh, inspiration arrives out of the clear blue sky. And then, whoosh, it is gone again. I once took a nap on a commuter train, and while I was asleep, I dreamed an entire short story absolutely intact. I awoke from my dream, grabbed a pen, and wrote down that story in one fevered burst of inspiration. This was the closest I've ever come to having a pure Ruth Stone moment. Some channel opened wide within me, and the words poured forth for page after page without any effort whatsoever. When I finished writing that short story, I barely had to revise a word of it. It felt right just the way it was. It felt right, and it felt strange. It wasn't even the kind of thing I would normally write about. Several reviewers later took note of how different that story was from others in my collection. One critic, tellingly, described it as Yankee magic realism. It was a tale of enchantment written under enchantment, and even a stranger could feel the fairy dust in it. I've never written anything like it before or since. I still think of that short story as the most superbly formed hidden jewel I've ever unburied in myself. That was big magic at play, unmistakably. But that was also 22 years ago. And it has never happened again. And believe me, I've taken a lot of naps on a lot of trains in the meantime. I've had moments of wondrous creative communion since then, but nothing so pure and exhilarating as that one wild encounter. It came, and then it went. What I'm saying is this. If my plan is to sit around waiting for another such unadulterated and impassioned creative visitation, I may be waiting for a very long time. So I don't sit around waiting to write until my genius decides to pay me a visit. If anything, I have come to believe that my genius spends a lot of time waiting around for me, waiting to see if I'm truly serious about this line of work. I feel sometimes like my genius sits in the corner and watches me at my desk day after day, week after week, month after month, just to be sure that I really mean it, just to be sure that I'm really giving this creative endeavor my wholehearted effort. When my genius is convinced that I'm not just messing around here, he may show up and offer assistance. Sometimes that assistance will not arrive until 2 years into a project. Sometimes that assistance will not last for more than 10 minutes. When that assistance does arrive, that sense of the moving sidewalk beneath my feet, the moving sidewalk beneath my words, I am delighted and I go along for the ride. In such instances, I write like I am not quite myself. I lose track of time and space and self. While it's happening, I thank the mystery for its help. And when it departs, I let the mystery go, and I keep on working diligently anyhow, hoping that someday my genius will reappear. I work either way, you see, assisted or unassisted, because that is what you must do in order to live a fully creative life. I work steadily, and I always thank the process. Whether I am touched by grace or not, I thank creativity for allowing me to engage with it at all. Because either way, it's all kind of amazing what we get to do, what we get to attempt, what we sometimes get to commune with. Gratitude always. Always gratitude. A dazzled heart. And as for how Anne Patchett saw what happened between us, as for how she regarded our curious miracle about the Amazon jungle novel that had bounced out of my head and landed in hers. Well, Anne is a far more rational soul than I am, but even she felt that something rather supernatural had occurred. Even she felt that inspiration had slipped away from me and landed with a kiss upon her. In her subsequent letters to me, she was generous enough to always refer to her Amazon jungle novel as our Amazon jungle novel, as though she were the surrogate mother to an idea that I had conceived. That was gracious of her, but not at all true. As anyone who has ever read State of Wonder knows full well, that magnificent story is entirely Anne Patchett's. Nobody else could have written that novel as she wrote it. If anything, I had been the foster mother who'd kept the idea warm for a couple of years while it searched for its true and rightful collaborator. Who knows how many other writers that idea had visited over the years before it came into my care for a while, and then finally shifted over to Anne. Boris Pasternak described this phenomenon beautifully when he wrote, "No genuine book has a first page. Like the rustling of the forest, it is begotten God knows where, and it grows and it rolls, arousing the dense wilds of the forest until suddenly it begins to speak with all the treetops at once." All I know for certain is that this novel really wanted to be written, and it didn't stop its rolling search until it finally found the author who was ready and willing to take it on. Not later, not someday, not in a few years, not when times get better, not when life becomes easier, but right now. So that became Anne's story, which left me with nothing but a dazzled heart and the sense that I live in a most remarkable world, thick with mysteries. It all called to mind the British physicist Sir Arthur Eddington's memorable explanation of how the universe works. Something unknown is doing we don't know what. But the best part is, I don't need to know what. I don't demand a translation of the unknown. I don't need to understand what it all means or where ideas are originally conceived or why creativity plays out as unpredictably as it does. I don't need to know why we are sometimes able to converse freely with inspiration when at other times we labor hard in solitude and come up with nothing. I don't need to know why an idea visited you today and not me, or why it visited us both, or why it abandoned us both. None of us can know such things, for these are among the great enigmas. All I know for certain is that this is how I want to spend my life, collaborating to the best of my ability with forces of inspiration that I can neither see, nor prove, nor command, nor understand. It's a strange line of work, admittedly. I cannot think of a better way to pass my days. Part 3. Permission. Remove the suggestion box. I didn't grow up in a family of artists. I come from people who worked more regularly at life, you might say. My maternal grandfather was a dairy farmer. My paternal grandfather was a furnace salesman. Both my grandmothers were housewives, and so were their mothers, their sisters, their aunts. As for my parents, my father is an engineer and my mother is a nurse. And although they were the right age for it, my parents were never hippies, not in the least. They were far too conservative for such things. My dad spent the 1960s in college and the Navy. My mom spent those same years in nursing school, working night shifts at the hospital, and responsibly saving her money. After they were married, my dad got a job at a chemical company, and he worked there for 30 years. Mom worked part-time, became an active member of our local church, served on the school board, volunteered at the library, and visited the elderly and the housebound. They were responsible people, taxpayers, solid, voted for Reagan, twice. I learned how to be a rebel from them. Because just beyond the reach of their basic good citizenship, my parents did whatever the hell they wanted to do with their lives, and they did it with a rather fabulous sense of insouciance. My father decided that he didn't merely want to be a chemical engineer, he also wanted to be a Christmas tree farmer. And so, in 1973, he went and did that. He moved us out to a farm, cleared some land, planted some seedlings, and commenced with his project. He didn't quit his day job to follow his dream, he just folded his dream into his everyday life. He wanted to raise goats, too, so he acquired some goats. Brought them home in the backseat of our Ford Pinto. Had he ever raised goats? No, but he thought he could figure it out. It was the same thing when he became interested in beekeeping. He just got himself some bees and began. 35 years later, he still has those hives. When my father grew curious about things, he pursued them. He had solid faith in his own capabilities. And when my father needed something, which was rare, because he basically has the material needs of a hobo, he made it himself, or fixed it himself, or somehow cobbled it together himself, usually without referring to the instructions, and generally without asking the advice of an expert. My dad doesn't hold much respect for instructions or for experts. He is no more impressed by people's degrees than he is by other civilized niceties, such as building permits and no trespassing signs. For better or for worse, my dad taught me that the best place to pitch a tent will always be the spot marked no camping. My father really doesn't like being told what to do. His sense of individualistic defiance is so strong it's often comical. Back in the Navy, he was once commanded by his captain to make a suggestion box to put in the canteen. Dad dutifully built the box, nailed it to the wall, then wrote the first suggestion and dropped it through the slot. His note read, "I suggest that you remove the suggestion box." In many ways, he's a weird egg, my dad, and his hyper-anti-authoritarian instincts can border at times on the pathological. But I always suspected that he was kind of cool anyway, even back when I was an easily embarrassed child being driven around town in a Ford Pinto filled with goats. I knew that he was doing his own thing and following his own path, and I intuitively sensed that this made him, by definition, an interesting person. I didn't have a term for it back then, but I can see now that he was practicing something called creative living. I liked it. I also took note of it for when it came time to imagine my own life. It's not that I wanted to make any of the same choices my father had made. I am neither a farmer nor a Republican, but his example empowered me to forge my own way through the world however I liked. Also, just like my dad, I don't like people telling me what to do. While I am not at all confrontational, I am deeply stubborn. This stubbornness helps when it comes to the business of creative living. As for my mother, she's a slightly more civilized version of my dad. Her hair is always neat, and her kitchen is tidy, and her friendly, good Midwestern manners are impeccable. But don't underestimate her, because her will is made of titanium, and her talents are vast. She's a woman who always believed that she could build, sew, grow, knit, mend, patch, paint, or decoupage anything her family ever needed. She cut our hair, she baked our bread, she grew, harvested, and preserved our vegetables, she made our clothes, she birthed our baby goats, she slaughtered the chickens, then served them up for dinner. She wallpapered our living room herself, and she refinished our piano, which she had bought for $50 from a local church. She saved us trips to the doctor by patching us up on her own. She smiled sweetly at everyone and always acted like a total cooperator, but then she shaped her own world exactly to her liking while nobody was looking. I think it was my parents' example of quietly impudent self-assertion that gave me the idea that I could be a writer, or at least that I could go out there and try. I never recall my parents expressing any worry whatsoever at my dream of becoming a writer. If they did worry, they kept quiet about it, but honestly, I don't think they were concerned. I think they had faith that I would always be able to take care of myself because they had taught me to. Anyhow, the golden rule in my family is this: if you're supporting yourself financially and you're not bothering anyone else, then you're free to do whatever you want with your life. Maybe because they didn't worry too much about me, I didn't worry too much about me either. It also never occurred to me to go ask an authority figure for permission to become a writer. I'd never seen anybody in my family ask anyone for permission to do anything. They just made stuff. So that's what I decided to do. I decided to just go make stuff. Your permission slip. Here's what I'm getting at, dear ones. You do not need anybody's permission to live a creative life. Maybe you didn't receive this kind of message when you were growing up. Maybe your parents were terrified of risk in any form. Maybe your parents were obsessive-compulsive rule followers, or maybe they were too busy being melancholic depressives or addicts or abusers to ever use their imaginations toward creativity. Maybe they were afraid of what the neighbors would say. Maybe your parents weren't makers in the least. Maybe they were pure consumers. Maybe you grew up in an environment where people just sat around watching TV and waiting for stuff to happen to them. Forget about it. It doesn't matter. Look a little further back in your family's history. Look at your grandparents. Odds are pretty good they were makers. No? Not yet? Keep looking back then. Go back further still. Look at your great-grandparents. Look at your ancestors. Look at the ones who were immigrants or slaves or soldiers or farmers or sailors or the original people who watched the ships arrive with the strangers on board. Go back far enough, and you will find people who were not consumers, people who were not sitting around passively waiting for stuff to happen to them. You will find people who spent their lives making things. This is where you come from. This is where we all come from. Human beings have been creative beings for a really long time, long enough and consistently enough that it appears to be a totally natural impulse. To put the story in perspective, consider this fact. The earliest evidence of recognizable human art is 40,000 years old. The earliest evidence of human agriculture, by contrast, is only 10,000 years old. which means that somewhere in our collective evolutionary story, we decided it was way more important to make attractive, superfluous items than it was to learn how to regularly feed ourselves. The diversity in our creative expression is fantastic. Some of the most enduring and beloved artwork on Earth is unmistakably majestic. Some of it makes you want to drop to your knees and weep. Some of it doesn't, though. Some acts of artistic expression might stir and excite you, but bore me to death. Some of the art that people have created across the centuries is absolutely sublime, and probably did emerge from a grand sense of seriousness and sacredness. But a lot of it didn't. A lot of it is just folks messing around for their own diversion, making their pottery a little prettier, or building a nicer chair, or drawing penises on walls to pass the time, and that's fine too. You want to write a book, make a song, direct a movie, decorate pottery, learn a dance, explore a new land? You want to draw a penis on your wall? Do it! Who cares? It's your birthright as a human being, so do it with a cheerful heart. I mean, take it seriously, sure, but don't take it seriously. Let inspiration lead you wherever it wants to lead you. Keep in mind that for most of history, people just made things, and they didn't make such a big freaking deal out of it. We make things because we like making things. We pursue the interesting and the novel because we like the interesting and the novel. And inspiration works with us, it seems, because inspiration likes working with us, because human beings are possessed of something special, something extra, something unnecessarily rich, something that the novelist Marilyn Robinson calls an overabundance that is magical. That magical overabundance, that's your inherent creativity, humming and stirring quietly in its deep reserve. Are you considering becoming a creative person? Too late, you already are one. To even call somebody a creative person is almost laughably redundant. Creativity is the hallmark of our species. We have the senses for it, we have the curiosity for it, we have the opposable thumbs for it, we have the rhythm for it, we have the language and the excitement and the innate connection to divinity for it. If you are alive, you're a creative person. You and I and everyone you know are descended from tens of thousands of years of makers. Decorators, tinkerers, storytellers, dancers, explorers, fiddlers, drummers, builders, growers, problem solvers, and embellishers. These are our common ancestors. The guardians of high culture will try to convince you that the arts belong only to a chosen few, but they are wrong, and they are also annoying. We are all the chosen few. We are all makers by design. Even if you grew up watching cartoons in a sugar stupor from dawn to dusk, creativity still lurks within you. Your creativity is way older than you are, way older than any of us. Your very body and your very being are perfectly designed to live in collaboration with inspiration, and inspiration is still trying to find you the same way it hunted down your ancestors. All of which is to say, you do not need a permission slip from the principal's office to live a creative life. Or if you do worry that you need a permission slip, there, I just gave it to you. I just wrote it on the back of an old shopping list. Consider yourself fully accredited. Now go make something. Decorate yourself. I have a neighbor who gets tattoos all the time. Her name is Eileen. She acquires new tattoos the way I might acquire a new pair of cheap earrings, just for the heck of it, just on a whim. She wakes up some mornings in a funk and announces, "I think I'll go get a new tattoo today." If you ask Eileen what kind of tattoo she's planning on getting, she'll say, "Oh, I don't know. I'll figure it out when I get to the tattoo shop, or I'll just let the artist surprise me." Now, this woman is not a teenager with impulse control issues. She's a grown woman with adult children who runs a successful business. She's also very cool, uniquely gorgeous, and one of the most free spirits I've ever met. When I asked her once how she could allow her body to be marked up so casually with permanent ink, she said, "Oh, but you misunderstand. It's not permanent. It's just temporary." Confused, I asked, "You mean all your tattoos are temporary?" She smiled and said, "No, Liz, my tattoos are permanent. It's just my body that's temporary. So is yours. We're only here on Earth for a short while, so I decided a long time ago that I wanted to decorate myself as playfully as I can while I still have time." I love this so much, I can't even tell you. Because like Eileen, I also want to live the most vividly decorated temporary life that I can. I don't just mean physically, I mean emotionally, spiritually, intellectually. I don't want to be afraid of bright colors or new sounds or big love or risky decisions or strange experiences or weird endeavors or sudden changes or even failure. Mind you, I'm not going to go out and cover myself with tattoos simply because that doesn't happen to be my jam, but I am going to spend as much time as I can creating delightful things out of my existence because that's what brings me awake and that's what brings me alive. I do my decorating with printer ink, not tattoo ink. But my urge to write comes from exactly the same place as Eileen's urge to turn her skin into a vivid canvas while she's still here. It comes from a place of, hey, why not? Because it's all just temporary. Entitlement. In order to live this way, free to create, free to explore, you must possess a fierce sense of personal entitlement, which I hope you will learn to cultivate. I recognize that the word entitlement has dreadfully negative connotations, but I'd like to appropriate it here and put it to good use, because you will never be able to create anything interesting out of your life if you don't believe that you're entitled to at least try. Creative entitlement doesn't mean behaving like a princess or acting as though the world owes you anything whatsoever. No, creative entitlement simply means believing that you are allowed to be here, and that merely by being here, you are allowed to have a voice and a vision of your own. The poet, David White, calls this sense of creative entitlement the arrogance of belonging and claims that it is an absolutely vital privilege to cultivate if you wish to interact more vividly with life. Without this arrogance of belonging, you will never be able to take any creative risks whatsoever. Without it, you will never push yourself out of the suffocating insulation of personal safety and into the frontiers of the beautiful and the unexpected. The arrogance of belonging is not about egotism or self-absorption. In a strange way, it's the opposite. It's a divine force that will actually take you out of yourself and allow you to engage more fully with life. Because often what keeps you from creative living is your self-absorption, your self-doubt, your self-disgust, your self-judgment, your crushing sense of self-protection. The arrogance of belonging pulls you out of the darkest depths of self-hatred, not by saying, I am the greatest, but merely by saying, I am here. I believe that this good kind of arrogance, this simple entitlement to exist and therefore to express yourself, is the only weapon with which to combat the nasty dialogue that may automatically arise within your head whenever you get an artistic impulse. You know the nasty dialogue I mean, right? I'm talking about the nasty dialogue that goes like this. Who the hell do you think you are trying to be creative? You suck. You're stupid. You have no talent and you serve no purpose. Get back in your hole. To which you may have spent a lifetime obediently responding, you're right, I do suck and I am stupid. Thank you. I'll go back in my hole now. I would like to see you engaged in a more generative and interesting conversation with yourself than that. For heaven's sake, at least defend yourself. Defending yourself as a creative person begins by defining yourself. It begins when you declare your intent. Stand up tall and say it aloud, whatever it is. I'm a writer. I'm a singer. I'm an actor. I'm a gardener. I'm a dancer. I'm an inventor. I'm a photographer. I'm a chef. I'm a designer. I am this and I am that and I am also this other thing too. I don't yet know exactly what I am, but I'm curious enough to go find out. Speak it. Let it know you're there. Hell, let you know you're there, because this statement of intent is just as much an announcement to yourself as it is an announcement to the universe or anybody else. Hearing this announcement, your soul will mobilize accordingly. It will mobilize ecstatically, in fact, because this is what your soul was born for. Trust me, your soul has been waiting for you to wake up to your own existence for years. But you must be the one to start that conversation, and then you must feel entitled to stay in that conversation. This proclamation of intent and entitlement is not something you can do just once and then expect miracles. It's something you must do daily, forever. I've had to keep defining and defending myself as a writer every single day of my adult life, constantly reminding and re-reminding my soul and the cosmos that I'm very serious about the business of creative living, and that I will never stop creating, no matter what the outcome, and no matter how deep my anxieties and insecurities may be. Over time, I've found the right tone of voice for these assertions, too. It's best to be insistent, but affable. Repeat yourself, but don't get shrill. Speak to your darkest and most negative interior voices the way a hostage negotiator speaks to a violent psychopath. Calmly, but firmly. Most of all, never back down. You cannot afford to back down. The life that you are negotiating to save, after all, is your own. Who the hell do you think you are? Your darkest interior voices will demand. It's funny you should ask, you can reply. I'll tell you who I am. I am a child of God, just like anybody else. I am a constituent of this universe. I have invisible spirit benefactors who believe in me and who labor alongside me. The fact that I am here at all is evidence that I have a right to be here. I have a right to my own voice and a right to my own vision. I have a right to collaborate with creativity because I myself am a product and a consequence of creation. I'm on a mission of artistic liberation, so let the girl go. See? Now you're the one doing the talking. Originality versus authenticity. Maybe you fear that you are not original enough. Maybe that's the problem. You're worried that your ideas are commonplace and pedestrian, and therefore unworthy of creation. Aspiring writers will often tell me, I have an idea, but I'm afraid it's already been done. Well, yes, it probably has already been done. Most things have already been done, but they have not yet been done by you. By the time Shakespeare was finished with his run on life, he'd pretty much covered every storyline there is, but that hasn't stopped nearly 5 centuries of writers from exploring the same storylines all over again. And remember, many of those stories were already clichés, long before even Shakespeare got his hands on them. When Picasso saw the ancient cave paintings at Lascaux, he reportedly said, "We have learned nothing in 12,000 years," which is probably true, but so what? So what if we repeat the same themes? So what if we circle around the same ideas again and again, generation after generation? So what if every new generation feels the same urges and asks the same questions that humans have been feeling and asking for years? We're all related, after all. So there's going to be some repetition of creative instinct. Everything reminds us of something. But once you put your own expression and passion behind an idea, that idea becomes yours. Anyhow, the older I get, the less impressed I become with originality. These days, I'm far more moved by authenticity. Attempts at originality can often feel forced and precious, but authenticity has a quiet resonance that never fails to stir me. Just say what you want to say, then, and say it with all your heart. Share whatever you are driven to share. If it's authentic enough, believe me, it will feel original. Motives. Oh, and here's another thing. You are not required to save the world with your creativity. Your art not only doesn't have to be original, in other words, it also doesn't have to be important. For example, whenever anybody tells me that they want to write a book in order to help other people, I always think, oh, please don't. Please don't try to help me. I mean, it's very kind of you to want to help people, but please don't make it your sole creative motive, because we will feel the weight of your heavy intention, and it will put a strain upon our souls. It reminds me of this wonderful adage from the British columnist Catherine Whitehorn. You can recognize the people who live for others by the haunted look on the faces of the others. I would so much rather that you wrote a book in order to entertain yourself than to help me. Or if your subject matter is darker and more serious, I would prefer that you made your art in order to save yourself or to relieve yourself of some great psychic burden rather than to save or relieve us. I once wrote a book in order to save myself. I wrote a travel memoir in order to make sense of my own journey and my own emotional confusion. All I was trying to do with that book was figure myself out. In the process, though, I wrote a story that apparently helped a lot of other people figure themselves out, but that was never my intention. If I'd sat down to write Eat, Pray, Love with the sole aim of helping others, I would have produced an entirely different book. I might have even produced a book that was insufferably unreadable. Okay, admittedly, a lot of critics found Eat, Pray, Love insufferably unreadable as it was, but that's not my point. My point is that I wrote that book for my own purposes, and maybe that's why it felt genuine and ultimately even helpful to many readers. Consider this very book, for example. Big Magic is obviously a self-help guide, right? But with all due respect and affection, I did not write this book for you. I wrote it for me. I wrote this book for my own pleasure because I truly enjoy thinking about the subject of creativity. It's enjoyable and useful for me to meditate on this topic. If what I've written here ends up helping you, that's great, and I will be glad. That would be a wonderful side effect. But at the end of the day, I do what I do because I like doing it. I have a friend who's a nun who has spent her entire life working to help the homeless of Philadelphia. She is something close to a living saint. She's a tireless advocate for the poor and the suffering and the lost and the abandoned. And do you know why her charitable outreach is so effective? Because she likes doing it. Because it's enjoyable for her. Otherwise, it wouldn't work. Otherwise, it would just be hard duty and grim martyrdom. But Sister Mary Scullion is no martyr. She's a cheerful soul who's having a wonderful time living out the existence that best suits her nature and most brings her to life. It just so happens that she takes care of a lot of other people in the process, but everyone can sense her genuine enjoyment behind the mission, which is ultimately why her presence is so healing. It's okay if your work is fun for you, is what I'm saying. It's also okay if your work is healing for you, or fascinating for you, or redemptive for you, or if it's maybe just a hobby that keeps you from going crazy. It's even okay if your work is totally frivolous. That's allowed. It's all allowed. Your own reasons to create are reason enough. Merely by pursuing what you love, you may inadvertently end up helping us plenty. There is no love which does not become help, taught the theologian Paul Tillich. Do whatever brings you to life, then. Follow your own fascinations, obsessions, and compulsions. Trust them. Create whatever causes a revolution in your heart. The rest of it will take care of itself. Schooling. I never got an advanced degree in writing. I don't have an advanced degree in anything, actually. I graduated from NYU with a bachelor's degree in political science because you have to major in something, and I still feel lucky to have received what I consider to have been an excellent, old-fashioned, broad-minded liberal arts education. While I always knew that I wanted to be a writer, and while I took a few writing classes as an undergrad, I chose not to seek out a master's of fine arts in creative writing once I was finished at NYU. I was suspicious of the idea that the best place for me to find my voice would be in a room filled with 15 other young writers trying to find their voices. Also, I wasn't exactly sure what an advanced degree in creative writing would afford me. Going to an art school is not like going to a dentistry school, for instance, where you can be pretty certain of finding a job in your chosen field once your studies are over. And while I do think it's important for dentists to be officially credentialed by the state, and airline pilots and lawyers and manicurists for that matter, I am not convinced that we need officially credentialed novelists. History seems to agree with me on this point. 12 North American writers have won the Nobel Prize in Literature since 1901. Not one of them had an MFA. 4 of them never even got past high school. These days, there are plenty of staggeringly expensive schools where you can go to study the arts. Some of them are fabulous, some of them not so much. If you want to take that path, go for it. But know that it's an exchange, and make certain that this exchange truly benefits you. What the schools get from the exchange is clear, your money. What the students get out of the exchange depends on their devotion to learning, the seriousness of the program, and the quality of the teachers. To be sure, you can learn discipline in these programs, and style, and perhaps even courage. You may also meet your tribe at art school, those peers who will provide valuable professional connections and support for your ongoing career. You might even be lucky enough to find the mentor of your dreams in the form of a particularly sensitive and engaged teacher. But I worry that what students of the arts are often seeking in higher education is nothing more than proof of their own legitimacy, proof that they are for real as creative people because their degree says so. On one hand, I completely understand this need for validation. It's an insecure pursuit to attempt to create. But if you're working on your craft every day on your own with steady discipline and love, then you are already for real as a creator, and you don't need to pay anybody to affirm it for you. If you've already gone out and earned yourself an advanced degree in some creative field or another, no worries. If you're lucky, it made your art better, and at the very least, I'm sure it did you no harm. Take whatever lessons you learned at school and use them to improve your craft. Or if you're getting a degree in the arts right now and you can honestly and easily afford to do so, that's also fine. If your school gave you a free ride, better still. You're fortunate to be there, so use that good fortune to your advantage. Work hard, make the most of your opportunities, and grow, grow, grow. This can be a beautiful time of focused study and creative expansion. But if you're considering some sort of advanced schooling in the arts, and you're not rolling in cash, I'm telling you, you can live without it. You can certainly live without the debt, because debt will always be the abattoir of creative dreams. One of the best painters I know is a teacher at one of the world's most esteemed art schools, but my friend himself does not have an advanced degree. He is a master, yes, but he learned his mastery on his own. He became a great painter because he worked devilishly hard for years to become a great painter. Now he teaches others at a level that he himself was never taught, which kind of makes you question the necessity of the whole system. But students flock from all over the world to study at this school, and many of those students, the ones who are not from wealthy families or who did not get a full ride of scholarships from the university, come out of that program with tens of thousands of dollars of debt. My friend cares immensely about his students, and so watching them fall so deeply into debt, while paradoxically they strive to become more like him, makes this good man feel sick in the heart, and it makes me feel sick in the heart too. When I asked my friend why they do it, why these students mortgage their futures so deeply for a few years of creative study, he said, well, the truth is they don't always think it through. Most artists are impulsive people who don't plan very far ahead. Artists by nature are gamblers. Gambling is a dangerous habit. But whenever you make art, you're always gambling. You're rolling the dice on the slim odds that your investment of time, energy, and resources now might pay off later in a big way, that somebody might buy your work and that you might become successful. Many of my students are gambling that their expensive education will be worth it in the long run. I get this. I've always been creatively impulsive, too. It comes with the territory of curiosity and passion. I take leaps and gambles with my work all the time, or at least I try to. You must be willing to take risks if you want to live a creative existence. But if you're going to gamble, know that you are gambling. Never roll the dice without being aware that you are holding a pair of dice in your hands, and make certain that you can actually cover your bets, both emotionally and financially. My fear is that many people pay through the nose for advanced schooling in the arts without realizing that they're actually gambling, because on the surface, it can look like they're making a sound investment in their future. After all, isn't school where people go to learn a profession? And isn't a profession a responsible and respectable thing to acquire? But the arts are not a profession in the manner of regular professions. There is no job security in creativity, and there never will be. Going into massive debt in order to become a creator, then, can make a stress and a burden out of something that should only ever have been a joy and a release. And after having invested so much in their education, artists who don't immediately find professional success, which is most artists, can feel like failures. Their sense of having failed can interfere with their creative self-confidence and maybe even stop them from creating at all. Then they're in the terrible position of having to deal not only with a sense of shame and failure, but also with steep monthly bills that will forever remind them of their shame and failure. Please understand that I am not against higher education by any means. I am merely against crippling indebtedness, particularly for those who wish to live a creative life. And recently, at least here in America, the concept of higher education has become virtually synonymous with crippling indebtedness. Nobody needs debt less than an artist, so try not to fall into that trap. And if you have already fallen into that trap, try to claw your way out of it by any means necessary as soon as you can. Free yourself so that you can live and create more freely, as you were designed by nature to do. Be careful with yourself, is what I'm saying. Be careful about safeguarding your future, but also about safeguarding your sanity. Try this instead. Instead of taking out loans to go to a school for the arts, maybe try to push yourself deeper into the world, to explore more bravely, or go more deeply and bravely inward. Take an honest inventory of the education you already have, the years you have lived, the trials you have endured, the skills you have learned along the way. If you are a young person, open your eyes wide and let the world educate you to the fullest extent. Ascend no longer from the textbook, warned Walt Whitman, and I warn it too. There are many ways to learn that do not necessarily involve schoolrooms. And feel free to start sharing your perspective through creativity, even if you're just a kid. If you are young, you see things differently than I do, and I want to know how you see things. We all want to know. When we look at your work, whatever your work may be, we will want to feel your youth, that fresh sense of your recent arrival here. Be generous with us. Let us feel it. After all, for many of us, it has been so long since we stood where you now stand. If you are older, trust that the world has been educating you all along. You already know so much more than you think you know. You are not finished. You're merely ready. After a certain age, no matter how you've been spending your time, you have very likely earned a doctorate in living. If you're still here, if you have survived this long, it is because you know things. We need you to reveal to us what you know, what you have learned, what you've seen and felt. If you are older, chances are strong that you may already possess absolutely everything you need to possess in order to live a more creative life, except the confidence to actually do your work. But we need you to do your work. Whether you are young or old, we need your work in order to enrich and inform our own lives. So take your insecurities and your fears and hold them upside down by the ankles and shake yourself free of all your cumbersome ideas about what you require and how much you need to pay in order to become creatively legitimate.